Let's start. Thank you very much, everybody. I know that there were some telephone calls, that there are some problems in Libya. You can see how directly related are some theoretical reflections and certain events in Libya, and some persons couldn't come because of something happening in Libya. To say the truth, I do not know what is happening. We had all day meeting in the morning. I'm very happy to have two close friends of mine here, and very, very well known both persons, Ivan Krastev, who is almost every day somewhere in Polish press with his interviews or his article, and Mark Leonard. I'm sure he will be more and more present. We are three at the ECFR, European Council on Foreign Relations. The occasion of our meeting, as you know, is the report they wrote both, which provoked a lot of debates and quite violent of them. To say the truth, I participated in some of those debates, although this is the first in Poland debate. This is a Polish title, Widmo Europy Wielobiegunowej. To say the truth, the original title was a little bit different, and the change was already significant. I understand that you, or most of you, know the text, but I would like to invite both Ivan and Mark to present some introductory words about their thinking on the subject, which is here in their essay. I don't know who will start. Mark.
Thank you very much for the introduction, but also for hosting us, because I've always been a massive admirer of you of your thinking and of everything that you've done. But I have to say that the fact that you arranged to get this translated into Polish and that you're hosting us here today, in spite of your grave doubts about many of the ideas and the proposals and the thing, does really show that how committed you are to intellectual debate and to the power of ideas. And it's a great privilege to be here today, launching it, and to have the opportunity to debate and to discuss it with you.
Mark, I'm happy that you didn't use the word liberal, how liberal I am, right? Because this is a bad word in Polish today, not only in Poland, as you know.
So, as Alex said, there's been a lively debate and discussion around this report, both before it came out and also since it came out. And in a way, that was one of the reasons we wrote the report, because we felt that the debate and the discourse within Europe about our security situation was disconnected from the reality of the world that we're in. And we've had a number of debates for the last decade which have passed for a security debate about NATO versus ESDP, about whether to engage or contain Russia, about whether Turkey should be in or outside of the European Union. Whilst that was going on, the European continent has changed dramatically. And our main purpose in writing this report was actually to try and push everybody to reframe their thinking about European security, and to challenge the idea that Europe exists, that there is a European order that was created after the Cold War, and that it is an order that we have to do everything we can to defend. And the backdrop to this discussion is the coverage of events in the Middle East and North Africa, which I think points out very clearly the fragility of our ideas of order. And we had a debate yesterday, a public debate, where we were talking about Europe in the world and various different things. And one of the really interesting things that came up was some of the parallels and differences between the Middle East and 1989. On the one hand, the images look so similar and so familiar. At the same time, the feeling in Western capitals is not one of triumph as it was in 1989, because even though the new regions might be more democratic, they're also bound to be less Western in their outlook. And many people have analysed the current situation in terms of the empowering effect of the internet, the rise of radical Islam, but another way of looking at what's going on is to see it in terms of a decline of the West and the rise of a more multipolar European space. And I think in that sense, even though our report isn't looking at North Africa, it does make a good backdrop to the discussion of the report. So I'm going to talk a bit about some of the background thinking behind the report and some of our analysis of what's going on at the moment, and then Ivan will talk about our new way of thinking about security and the new way of thinking about order for the European continent. So our starting point was that Europeans were very quick to spot the emergence of a multipolar world and to talk about a multipolar world, but we've been much less quick to spot the fact that our own continent is becoming more multipolar. And that's a natural phenomenon, because the 1990s, in many ways, was Europe's unipolar moment. We had a hope that American hard power would underpin the spread of European soft power and the integration of all the nations of Europe into a single liberal order, which would be institutionally embodied in NATO and the European Union. And it would be an order which had a completely different set of rules, where the rule of law, pooled sovereignty, interdependence would gradually replace military conflict, the balance of power, and spheres of influence. And I think most people expected that these Cold War institutions could gradually expand until they contained enough European states to provide an institutional embodiment of a new European order, a post-Cold War order. And beyond that, I think people hoped that the European neighbourhood policy would bring some of the same benefits of stability and political reform and a shared sphere of influence to countries south of the Mediterranean as well. And what we're seeing now, I think, is that this vision for unipolar, multilateral European order is starting to become unstuck. In many ways, the events in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya are part of a wider crisis of the European neighbourhood, which we've seen erupt in recent months, from Albania to Belarus to Ukraine, which is not going in the same direction that many people hoped it was going to in a few years ago. And the reasons for that are that each of the core pillars of that unipolar, multilateral idea of order is starting to come unstuck. So Russia was never comfortable with the enlargement of NATO or the European Union, but now it's powerful enough to openly call for a new European security architecture and to block de facto the enlargement of NATO. Turkey still wants to join the European Union, but it's increasingly pursuing an independent foreign policy. It's looking for a larger role. It's not satisfied with its post-Cold War role of being a vassal to the United States and a supplicant to the European Union. And the United States is still certainly a European power. It maintains its Article 5 commitments, but with its hands full dealing with Afghanistan, Iran, the rise of China, it has ceased to be a full-time European power and ideally wants to return to some form of offshore balancing, where it does enough to make Article 5 stick and to make sure that there isn't a war between major European states, but no more than that. And the fourth big trend, I think, is the fact that the countries of the neighbourhood are not operating in the way that they would if this unipolar, multilateral vision was true. What we're seeing when we look at Ukraine and other countries is that they seem to be balancers that are playing the Europeans off against the Russians rather than joiners, who are desperate to absorb the acquis communautaire and to become like us. And finally, the European Union itself, which has always had a mix of universalism and exceptionalism, seems to have lost some of that universal urge, and that the support for enlarging both NATO and the European Union is at a historically low ebb. Even though member states are divided, there isn't a consensus in favour of enlarging either of them. So if you add all of these things together, what you can start to see is the beginnings of a multipolar Europe looming on the horizon. And the dilemma facing the European Union in its own continent is very similar to that faced by the United States at a global level. We can do very little to prevent the evolution from a unipolar to a multipolar European order. But we can do quite a lot to shape the relations between the emerging poles within Europe. But so far, because we've been in denial of that happening, and because we felt that there was an order which we had to defend, what we've seen is, in fact, the creation of a de facto multipolar Europe. So we've seen that the existing institutions were unable to do much to stop core threats to European security, from the Kosovo crisis to the arms race in the Caucasus, to cuts in the EU's gas supply in 2008, to the Russia-Georgian war, instability in Kyrgyzstan, let alone making progress in resolving the frozen conflicts. And although European governments are aware of the rising instability of the European neighbourhood, most member states have bet on a preservation of the status quo and have refused to engage with Russian and other demands to talk about a new European security architecture. But by adopting this more passive approach, we think that European leaders have unwittingly made a multipolar Europe more likely. Because it's almost impossible to work through the formal institutions. Each of the continent's major powers, the European Union, Russia and Turkey, have increasingly been working around them. So the European Union recognized the independence of Kosovo, or some member states did, in spite of Russian opposition. Russia recognized the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia in spite of EU opposition. Turkey cooperated with Brazil on the Iranian nuclear question without going through NATO and trying to coordinate itself with the key European member states that had been driving diplomacy towards Iran. And those are all manifestations of the sort of de facto spheres of influence, where people are doing what they can get away with in their own area spheres of influence, and going around rather than through the institutions. And the strange thing about this situation is that whilst it's Russia and Turkey that complain the loudest about the current institutions and about the status quo, it's in fact us as Europeans who have the most to lose from the breakdown of that institutional order and the blockage of those institutions, because we have made a massive historical bet on preserving security through institutional cooperation, through the rule of law, rather than through a balance of power. Whereas Russia and Turkey haven't made that sort of ideological leap yet and have a more balanced portfolio of tools which they use to think about order. So that's really our analysis of the situation, and that led us to try and think in creative terms about whether it was possible to imagine a different model for thinking about European order, which was neither based on the perpetual enlargement of Cold War institutions, nor a return to 19th century spheres of influence, where the countries that aren't great powers are simply sandwiched in between these great powers and have their fate determined in other capitals. So that was the backdrop to our report, and it led us both to try and reimagine the European space in a way that Ivan is going to describe, but also to try and think of more creative institutional embodiments which could breathe life into the multilateral institutions that have embodied European values and have done so much to give us security in the immediate post-Cold Era, but which are now looking increasingly troubled and disconnected.
Ivan.
Thank you very much. I got cold, so as a result of it, I hope I'll be brief, which is going to be my major contribution. But let's start with the fact that, as everybody said, the report produced quite a lot of disagreement. And for us, of course, we want to provoke debate. We're not sure that we wanted to provoke scandal. And part of the story is it was very divisive, but people it divided basically on two groups, those who dislike it and those who hate it. And we were the third group, probably. What was interesting is that people has been attacking from a totally different positions. For example, some said Turkey is never going to like this report. They liked it. Others said they're going to like it too much. And I'm asking this question because this is kind of my introduction to the way we're talking about European security. I do believe this is slightly like with the financial crisis. In the report, there are some weaknesses with which I can start in order to make it much easier for us to debate, just to know where we do believe that weaknesses are. If you're going to skip the summary, which was very much the result of the internal debate in the Council, and we made our compromises, and the policy recommendations where we decided to be constructive without knowing how to be, I do believe it's going to be a much more interesting read. Because we still stay very strongly on our major analysis of the situation, and this analysis is based on the fact that European Union now is much more afraid than somebody is going to say the status quo does not work, than basically of what's happening on the ground. More people hated us because of what we said it, not because they believed that it was wrong. Because they do believe that if we're not going to say this, in a certain way, this is the best policy that we can have. This is really like in the financial crisis in which you're fighting much more the panic than the sources of the crisis. And here comes where basically where was our reimagining the European order. We start with the fact that if there is only one institution that we have been imagining that is going to represent European order after, not after 1989, to be honestly honest, after the Yugoslav wars. Because after 1989, strangely enough, neither the enlargement of European Union nor the enlargement of NATO was in the cards. It was very much, especially in the case of NATO, the Yugoslav wars, that changed the American heart on NATO and NATO enlargement. But if there is only two institutions that have been the symbol of European order, this have been the enlarging NATO and the enlarging EU. This is why we didn't care so much of creating any new institutions, because we believe that at the end of the day, probably it's going to take much more time for countries like Ukraine or even Russia, but they are going to convert towards our own understanding of security. So it was about waiting for them to be prepared. And my idea is that this is how we have been acting. But what happened is that first, we're talking enlargement, but we're not doing much of an enlargement. And if you go into domestic politics of the important European member states, you're going to see that with the exception of the Balkans, where the real problem is, if you're not going to get them in, what you're doing with them. And the real dilemma of the European Union there is to be a classical colonial power, because European Union is running places like Kosovo and Bosnia anyway, or to try to find some way of integration, the enthusiasm for enlargement is going down. Of course, we're not declaring that there is no enthusiasm, but we discover that, for example, Timoshenko is not so beautiful as we believed, basically the Turks are not so pro-Western as we believed, and so on. We're trying to find a serious excuses why we cannot do this and that. I do believe that meanwhile, probably what we should do is to try to look back in these 20 years and to realize that it was not simply the enlargement of the European Union and NATO that have been happening. And here we claim that there were four parallel projects that have been developing as the result of the end of the Cold War. And they now should coexist in Europe. And by the way, in Europe, which is losing parts of its centrality in global politics. And this project is on one level, of course, the enlarged European Union, project which is vulnerable enough, and this was seen during the Euro crisis, where there is a structural kind of problems within the project, but where also there is a project that has lost its narrative and part of the legitimacy for its voters. So you have these very strong anti-elite sentiments which are destroying basically and threatening the EU project. So even European Union cannot be taken for granted. On the other side, when we're talking Russia, I do believe we're always going into extremes. Either believing that Russia is stronger than it is, or basically being that it's weaker than it is. In 1990s, basically, we pretend that Russia has almost disappeared. Now with Putin, basically, we started to believe that Russia is extremely strong, extremely efficient, achieving here and there. There are many people criticizing the Putin's project, but the problem is not even simply how bad the project is. The problem is that he failed to realize it. Russia is the nation state. This was never part of Russia's history. So from this point of view, for the Russians, Russia as the nation state is as novel project as European Union is for Europeans. And if you look at what's happening after a decade of Putin rule, you can see that basically the Russian state is neither as strong as we believe, neither as coherent as we believed. As a result of the financial crisis, also the Russian political elites lost their self-confidence. We're just giving some figures, but let's give you three figures which probably could be more new for you. In year 2009, the number of the Russian officials, soldiers and policemen being killed in Northern Caucasus were twice higher than the numbers of the Americans being killed in Iraq. In their domestic political discourse, Russians are talking about North Caucasus as the internal abroad. I'm claiming that the very territorial integrity of the Russian state cannot be taken for granted. Secondly, if in 2007 and 2008, the Russian political elite was very much playing with the idea of the BRIC identity, what Russians started to realize is that in a certain way, they're not the rising power from the point of view of China or India or Brazil. So it's not by accident that Medvedev came with the idea of the new European security architecture. Because plus trying to change the image and basically declaring that he's unhappy with the 1990s, there was one very important practical question. What to do with Central Asia? With whom you want to negotiate in Central Asia? With Europeans or with the Chinese? And from this point of view, for the first time, Russia feels less developed than any of the major powers it neighbors. It's now less developed than China, which was never the case, less developed than Poland, less developed than Eastern Europe. And this situation basically is changing their time perspective very different from the Chinese, because the Chinese said, let's negotiate, but not now. Let's do it tomorrow. They believe that tomorrow they can get a better deal. This is why, for example, we believe that one Russian today said, let's negotiate. They have an interest to negotiate, and they have an interest to negotiate now, because they are going to have a better deal now than tomorrow. But the problem of the European Union is, normally you can think in these conditions better to negotiate with than tomorrow. But, and here is the problem of interdependency, we don't know what we should fear more, aggressive Russia or collapsing Russia. Gazprom, which is trying to influence its neighbors, or pipes which are not maintained and in which nobody is investing in the last 20 years and there is simply no gas going. And I do believe that this is one of the major stories. It appears that in modern Europe, in the Europe which we see, we are totally dependent on vulnerability of the others. And this is also the case with Turkey, because everybody knows quite a lot of Kemalist Turkey, but the post-Kemalist Turkey is also a new project, and it's a very divided society. I can see how people are easily taking sides, and one of the reasons people are either believing that Turkey is absolutely incredible and this is the most democratic thing that happened, or on the other side that it's totally Islamic. But this debate is based on a very simple fact. Nobody is really interested in what happens in Turkey. We're just debating between ourselves. We have taken one position on the other. We're defending this position. But it's neither or. Both trends are there. Turkey is obviously much more democratic. I'm not going to claim it's more westernized or more pro-Western than it was. And the fourth project, which I do believe is extremely important, is the state building, which happens in the territory of the former Soviet Union, outside of Russia and in the post-Yugoslav space. Because everybody tells the story of Europe as if for the last 20 years it was a kind of a peaceful, uneventful time. There was something of a transition, transformation of economy. Listen, more than dozens of states have appeared in the 1990s. On the level of the state births, Europe at the end of the 20th century can be compared only with Africa in the 1960s. And some of these states started having nothing but just their names and their borders. And as a result of this, the state-building process became very difficult, and some of their leaders, trying to keep, of course, their power positions, became very cunning. So while we have been believing that the Ukrainians all the time are deciding to go through the Russia with the Russians or on the West, I do believe that basically the Ukrainian political and business class have been using the resources coming both from Russia and from the West in order to do and their own state-building project. And they have been very carefully playing this game because this is what they have been very much interested about. As a result of this analysis, and this is my last point, basically we said that when we are talking about European order, and if we don't believe that this European order can be simply the enlargement of the European Union, the most important is to come with the European order, which first is going to maximize and on the institutional level the unity of the European Union, because European Union being not a nation state like the other players, even in making, could be much more vulnerable to any type of a non-institutional behavior. And secondly, when we're trying to keep a European order, we should keep in mind that the failure of the other projects, I mean the Russia state-building projects, the state-building projects in the post-Soviet and post-Yugoslav state, and the failure of the post-Kemalist Turkey could be for us not a lesser but a bigger problem than simply the aggressive and confrontational behavior on the base of these states. So probably I should stop here.
Let's start the discussion. We have, if I remember, we have time because they both are leaving Warsaw till 5:30. Is it okay? Okay, please, Mr. Trzaskowski, his European deputy.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation. I'm a member of the European Parliament from the Constitutional Committee, so I'm going to give you a European and constitutional twist, I guess. And I'm also responsible for European Parliament-Moldova relations, so a few words about that as a litmus test. I'm not so sure whether I'm one of those who actually dislikes your ideas or hates them. I don't think so. I'm just, in a sense, questioning some of your assumptions, and that's the only thing that I purport to do. And obviously, I could go on and on, talk about Russia and Turkey and so on, and for example, question your assumption that post-imperial Russia can be consolidated within its borders, and that's actually what it wants. But I'll leave it to better experts on Russia than me. And I'd like to focus on your assumptions about the European Union. And there's no doubt that whatever you propose is pretty courageous and, on the other hand, controversial. I mean, whatever we say, whether we agree, whether we disagree, we have to say that it's controversial. And therefore, one has to ask oneself a question, especially when we are going to dwell a little bit about the European Union internal situation, whether that's the most propitious moment to actually come up with such ideas, because you are saying that it would actually maximize unity within the European Union. And here I have my strongest doubts that whether in such difficult moments such controversial idea can actually maximize unity, because I am afraid that it would actually increase fragmentation. And that's the only problem that I have, you know, looking at it from the European perspective. What we are having now, interinstitutionally, we are having a huge enigma within the European Union. We have a lot of interinstitutional wrangling between the institutions, but not only between the institutions, but also between the member states and institutions. I mean, it's enough to look at the role of the presidency to actually see that. What will be the role, especially when it comes to foreign relations, of national presidencies? I mean, according to the treaty, not much. But we all know about the informal role of presidencies and so on and so forth, and we are in the process of actually establishing these boundaries. Moreover, I mean, you're making an assumption that the European Union will speak with one voice, and obviously here, a little bit as a devil's advocate, I will have to, looking at what's happening, I will have to question that assumption and at least say that we have to wait for a while, at least, when we will know what will happen with the Lisbon Treaty and with its implementation. So what I'm afraid of that we are in this moment of uncertainty, and that such bold ideas can actually increase the danger of fragmentation. I mean, look at what's happening with European External Action Service and the whole idea of some of the member states actually to go around it and to strengthen the intergovernmental method and to strengthen Van Rompuy. And how is that going to play out and what influence would it have on actually the Union's capability of speaking with one voice? I mean, there are many people in Europe who are now praying for the old good days of Solana and Ferrero Waldner to actually come back. When they look at the European Union's response to what is happening in Egypt, what was happening in Tunisia, what is happening in Libya, I don't have to talk about Ashton and her role and her role and the European Union's role, because I think that you all know it. And that's the biggest problem that is so very problematic. And I'm just going to finish with one example, which is Moldova, which I know best because I go there quite often and I talk to the people there. And one idea of the European Union, more precisely, it was a German idea then taken over by the European Commission. Just one simple idea when the Union speaks with one voice, which is to open certain EU programs and agencies for neighborhood countries, which is possible according to the European Commission and that has been established in 2007. And even on that, the European Union is unable to speak with one voice, unable to have some strategic thinking, which policies, which agencies we're going to open, which is should be at least quite simple as compared to your ideas in which, you know, one of the prerequisites would be for the European Union to speak with one voice. So finishing off, summing it up, I'm not attacking your ideas, I'm not hating them, but I'm just questioning your, first of all, the timing and the assumption, especially when it comes to the European Union, and I'm afraid that, first of all, we have to wait until, you know, we at least can start identifying what's happening with the European Union, and secondly, presenting such bold proposals, I'm afraid that it will not increase unity, but in a sense, for certain member states, would actually increase this temptation for fragmentation, especially with some of the bigger member states. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Please, who next? Ajan Anish, please.
This one?
For example.
Okay, thank you. I very much like this report, but I'm afraid it's empty. So the idea is beautiful, but it's not realistic in my eyes for several reasons, but let me point to only a few of them. One is the table of on the page 36, I guess, of your report. This is the perception of threats, English version, yeah.
Ah, English version, okay.
As seen by the Russian elites. I see none on the list that can be solved with the help of the European Union. What can we offer them? As for the most important things, the threats for Russia stem from within, or from the east, or from the south, not from the west. So we cannot help them in the most important issues. We have the framework. We are negotiating things with Russia to no avail for the time being. So what is the value added? And as for Turkey, even I wouldn't be so quick in assuming that nobody in Europe is discussing what's going on in Turkey. There are many groups, perfect European experts who are concentrating on Turkey and doing good job, so they know what's at stake. And then, of course, to follow up what Mr. Trzaskowski has said, I'm curious to see the Greeks raising their hands and voting for elevating Turkey to the major partner of Europe. Is this realistic? I doubt. The Cypriots themselves have the blocking power, because this is a political project, so it's going to go through the council, and we have the rules, unanimity. So this is not acceptable. And I find some practical things in your text that also raise my doubts. On the page 64, you write, as for the way in which the trilogue should be organized, you write, The trilogue would work to implement the agreements that the major powers have signed up to in different places. So as a matter of fact, you imagine those meetings as a kind of giving classes to Russians, because we do not have problems with agreements we have signed. I haven't heard about Turkey having problems with the things that they are signing. They are very cautious on signing anything. So what is the task? Teaching Russians to behave. I doubt if they would accept it. They have rejected participation in the neighborhood policy. Why? Because they are not equal to other neighbors. So are they equal to Turkey? Are they so small as Turkey is? So minor as an Islamic country? I very much doubt so. And then the European presence wouldn't help build relations between Russia and Turkey. Look how often the presidents, prime ministers of Turkey and Russia are meeting. They don't need an intervention from the European side. Just the opposite. They are rather behaving in a way that is not acceptable in Europe. So signing agreements or talking about agreements that go against the acquis communautaire, using the national currencies, free trade agreements, as Turkey does in the Middle East and with Russia. So the European presence would make them rather put them in an awkward position. And then you point to some problems that should be solved, that could be solved in triangular framework. Bosnia-Herzegovina. How Europe with Turkey and Russia is better than without? Yeah, of course it's nice to see mediation of Turkey. Yeah, but that can be arranged for bilaterally. The frozen conflicts. It's up to Russia, frankly speaking, to defroze them. Turkey wanted to manipulate with Russia with some optimistic, let's say, signals coming from time to time. And what is the result? So I simply don't see any practicality in this project, though it is beautiful. It is very nice. It's very elegant. Thank you.
The Ambassador Novak, please.
Thank you very much. I think I would follow more or less this line, but I'd like to rather look at the report from a Polish view, or the Polish view, if you wish. I think that you are drawing rightly the attention that at present Russia has not yet been in the right place as far as European security system is concerned. The deal, unwritten deal, which has been made in 91-92, which is composed of a number of elements, but you are mentioning here only one element, Paris Charter. But there are other elements, CFE in particular, etc. They did not solve the proper Russia's place in Europe. In Poland, we don't want generally to recognize that, because it would mean that Russia should have an increased role, perhaps. But the problem of an increased role of Russia is something which could be discussed, because it depends how it is shaped. But in Poland, I think now there are some elements here and there, very little discussion that something should be done. Let me suggest that what is appealing to myself much more than your concept is a concept which is, I think, originating mainly in Germany, Wolfgang Ischinger and others, in Poland to a certain extent, Adam Daniel Rotfeld. It is a concept of creating above a security community in which we would find a better place for Russia and slowly draw her to Europe, because both of us, both we need, Russia and Russia needs Europe. This security community would not affect NATO, would not affect Central Europe, because our problem from our perspective here, it is that does not solve two main questions which are very difficult for us. One is the Russian constant, persistent effort to divide NATO countries into old and new members, and new members, and as far as new members, they pretend they should have droit de regard. Second, they also would like to have a kind of, because they consider this to be, they say that this is a sphere, a zone of privileged interest, that is their term. And this is very close to the first point, of course. So this is not solved. Then there is another question yet. In your concept, it will be very difficult to solve the status of Ukraine, Belarus, Caucasus, and other states, which is also the problem of Europe. I have to confess that in this concept, which is not a German concept, in fact, but a little bit more, people are putting their own fingers into it. There is one weakness, which is not perhaps more, but one which is, of course, in your report is evident. That is lack of the place for Turkey. Although on Turkey I will not develop, because my knowledge on this is very scarce, and I would rather go along with this, what was said with Mr. Anich. So my question is, how do you see the relation between this concept and your concept? Thank you.
Please, yes, please.
Thank you very much, Łukasz Kulesa, National Security Bureau, but not an official voice of the National Security Bureau. I share the critical assessment of the idea of creating a permanent, albeit informal, form of cooperation and dialogue between the EU, Turkey, and Russia. So I won't repeat the critical comments. So as a permanent structure, not really. I don't see a strong agenda in there. But as a project-driven initiative, the question would be what kind of specific issues which would bind the European Union, Russia, and Ankara together. Not the hard security, because there, let's face it, you won't get very far without NATO. But energy issues, I don't know, anti-terrorist activities, would you have a list of specific projects which could be tackled in this particular format? That would be one question. The other question about the raising power and the raising profile of Turkey. Here, your assessment is kind of very a bit one. So I was wondering about your comments and your perspective on the recent, I wouldn't say failures, but recent problems with the Turkish foreign policy. You are mentioning the Turkish-Brazilian initiative about the Iranian nuclear program, but in fact it was an absolute failure. The big powers showed Turkey and Brazil that they are not there yet, that they are not playing in the right league, and the offer was completely rejected, and they were treated as intruders. The Middle Eastern policy, of course, the Arab Street may see Turkey as a model, but the damage done in the Turkish-Israeli relation is basically limiting the Turkey allure, the Turkey power of influence in the Middle East. Their strong point, as I see it, was that they could talk both to the Arab countries
and to Israel. Right now, it seems that they cannot no longer talk to Israel and be listened to. So I was wondering about your assessment of the recent issues in the Turkish foreign policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Thank you. Bartek Cichocki, National Security Bureau. A question about the U.S. Absent in this picture. Why is it so, with Madeleine Albright taking a lead during the pre-new strategic concept discussion within NATO, with the U.S. Taking a lead in the discussion, in the negotiations on CFE modernizations concerning the E is Europe, right, in the CFE. With START treaty, which we may like or dislike or find weaknesses there, or START being overvalued, but still President Obama saying that START treaty is his number one priority in foreign and security policy area, says that declaring the U.S. withdrawal from Europe is probably premature. Talking about START treaty, we have very strong statement on the U.S. commitment to missile defense in Europe by President Obama. So the question again, why do you so skeptically approach the U.S. being part of this whole issue? Thank you.
Krzysztof Bobiński.
Thank you very much. This is all terribly negative. I apologize, really. I mean, you've put so much work into this and talked to so many people, and then everyone's saying, this is all nonsense. I'm going to be negative too. My feeling is that what you've done with this report is that you've looked at the situation, which is that Turkey is not going into the European Union. Russia is saying we want to play a role in Europe, but no one is listening to them. And so what you've said is, well, let's take these two countries, third institution, and let's put them together in a trilateral arrangement, which is going to provide security. Well, it won't, because the European Union, as maybe Mr. Trzaskowski has suggested, or it implied maybe, isn't in a very stable situation at the moment. It's a bit wobbly, and certainly Russia is quite wobbly. The least wobbly leg of this trilateral arrangement that you're suggesting is maybe Turkey, which is sort of on the rise. But this doesn't solve this. What you're saying, you're looking at a situation where we have problems. You're saying let's put them together and we'll have security. Well, I don't think that's the case. I don't think this is at all useful. Even though Mr. Suat Kanyoglu has said that this is very thought-provoking, and then he says it can give a push to Turkey's integration in the European Union. Well, I'm sorry that Mr. Ananic did not mention something, an idea that he came up with at the beginning of last year, where he said that there was another triangle you came up with, and I hope you're going to confirm this. This is the triangle of the rejected three countries, Russia, Turkey, and Iran, wasn't it? And you suggested that these three countries were coming together, and they might come together against the European Union. I'd be grateful if you could maybe expand on that, if you still believe it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please, if not for the moment, maybe I will ask both speakers to answer, and we afterwards the second tour of question and answer. Please, who will start?
First, thank you very much, because you said that you're critical, but it was, at least for me, the most interesting discussion that we had. And some of the points, in fact, we agreed with, and I'm going to say on which. Some of them, I'll disagree, and I'll go very much, for example, about Turkey-Russia cooperation and basically why they need us. This is my problem. They're less and less needing us. And if we're going to allow the access of the excluded, I'm not going to put Iran there quickly, because Iran is much more sensitive for both of them. But for Turkey and Russia, now they're living in the best of all worlds. Turkey is part of the European negotiations. They want to get in, but they started to realize that there is some very nice things that happen to you in the waiting room. For example, you could be very selective of what kind of European initiative you're going to support and what not. You can be a free rider on many other issues, and you can reposition yourself in order to gain maximum influence. The Russians, this is why the Russians, by the way, the only people who never reacted to the report were the Russians, because on one level they don't like upgrading Turkey, because upgrading Turkey is slightly downgrading them. But on the other side, they want to Turk with Turks bilaterally. Yeah, and it's much easier for them to talk bilaterally. They can make energy deals. Basically, they share some common sensitivities when it comes to sovereignty and European security space in general. I can understand how European Union is benefiting of this situation. The fact that we are treating Turkey simply as an accession country, and this is why I said that there is no curiosity, because most of the Europeans going and studying Turkey, they're starting the accession talks with Turkey. We behaved as if Turkey is a bigger Bulgaria, so there is no other option for them than being in the European Union. But probably in their imagination, they have other options, and at least in the Vitoglou imagination, there could be other options. When you go to Russia, and I do believe this is extremely, extremely apt observation, that Russia, all the major security threats that they declare themselves, we cannot help them. But here comes the paradox of the Russian security framing. Just opposite to the European Union. European Union is always ready to frame its external threats as internal. When you have a terrorist threat, we're going to speak about social integration. Russia is the other way around. Most of their internal threats, they're going to frame as the external. For example, even in the problem of Chechnya, it's going to be much more their talk about international terrorism and others basically disrupting there. So from this point of view, I do believe that part of the pleasure of this, and using the East European metaphor, for me this trialogue was a kind of a roundtable talks on European security, where you're not writing a treaty like Medvedev was pushing for, because writing a treaty is not going to do anything special, but going from crisis to crisis and trying to first start framing security issues in a similar way. And then come the United States, because here the story is not that European Union wants European security architecture without the Americans. I do believe it's over. Even countries that during 2003 have been very much attracted by this, they don't buy this anymore. The problem is that America less and less is going to be interested in European security, and this is the classics that you can see in the reset. Reset is about treating Russia as a global power. Americans are negotiating with Russians on nukes, on Iran, on Afghanistan, but when it comes to Ukraine and others, they said, but it's European affairs. Talk to the European Union. And I do believe that Europeanization of European security is based not on the fact that America is not simply interested, but simply because American resources are constrained. And in American strategic imagination, Europe is a deal done. They see a secure place. And compared with Pakistan and Middle East, they're right. In a certain way, you're not going to concentrate your major resources here. And from my point of view, if you have this Europeanization of the European security space, which is coming by default, not by the choice of Europeans, then what we're doing, and what we're doing, and probably I'm wrong, is we're trying not to notice it. We're behaving as if 1990s are going to continue forever. And this is just the problem of time when we're going to expand here and there. And Turkey, of course, wants to be in, and Russians at the end of the day are going to buy part of our agenda. In the case of Russia, it's not simply that they're dividing and go bilateral. I do believe that there is something, and this is my last point, very fundamental, which is part of the experience in the last 20 years. Because of the trauma of the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russian policy elite does not believe in a post-national formations. For them, European Union is problematic. It's not simply that they want to divide. The problem is that they know how to deal with Germany. As you see, they even know how to deal with Poland. What they don't know is how to deal with European Union, and they don't know should they deal with this. But if they continue this policy for a long time, They're empowering nation states. And nation states more and more also realize that they can achieve something only dealing bilaterally. What we see at the moment is European Commission is playing the tough guy, going and talking to Russians everything that they don't want to be talked about. Energy charter, human rights, and so on, and all of the nation states making a classical realpolitik behind the Commission back. Is this policy strengthening the European Union or not? I agree very much with the unrealistic, which comes from everybody. It wasn't realistic. We knew it and probably made a mistake basically pushing for this. But there was only one important point that we wanted to make. In all the institutions that are now governing European security space, NATO, Organization for Security and Cooperation, all these stories, there is one big absent institutionally, and this is the European Union. European Union as a player is none of this. It's not present. But we created the external service. And my question is, what they're going to do? Where they're going to do it? What is the agenda on which they're going to be engaged? And from this point of view, slightly artificially, we decided to create a crisis and an institution in which through this crisis, basically, European Union thrashed and is entering this. The member states reacted exactly as you predicted, as a senior German official told us. They said, you have the right agenda and the wrong participants.
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just to build on that, you said we started out with these two critiques of timing and the assumption that that Europe will speak with one voice. I mean, on the timing front, I think the timing is actually quite urgent. Our relations with Turkey are completely dysfunctional, and we are at the moment only able to talk to Turkey about the accession negotiations, and the people who don't want Turkey to join control the agenda and are refusing to open any new chapters, and it's a conversation stopper. And yet our neighborhood is on fire, and you know, if ever we needed to talk to Turkey, it's now. We need to talk to them about the situation in North Africa. We need to talk to them about the situation in the Caucasus. We need to talk to them about how we create some order in a neighborhood which is overlapping. Turkey's got its neighborhood policy with 13 countries in it. The European Union has its neighborhood policy, which is in a state of crisis, which we're going to be rethinking. And it doesn't occur to the Turks, as Ivan said, they laugh if you talk to them about trying to align their neighborhood policy with the Eastern Partnership. I mean, they literally laughed when we talked to the Turks about this on our trip. And that's because, as Ivan said, they get the best of both worlds. They have a foreign policy that's entirely parasitic on their access to the European customs union and their ability to provide an entry into the European space, and yet they, because the EU has been so short-sighted and so focused on the accession, they don't feel any particular urge to coordinate or to reconcile their foreign policy with the European Union's foreign policy. So we get the worst of both worlds from that perspective. Russia, I think, is equally urgent. I will go to Russia quite often, and I have seen this incredible evolution in Russian foreign policy. And you know, I was last there in December this year, and December last year, a couple of months ago, and was struck by the incredible sense of unease, of weakness, the fact that the Russian model isn't working, that the country is stagnating, and the vulnerability which the elite feels. And as Ivan said, it's fascinating because it's almost the mirror image of what you get in Europe as a result of the crisis. So the European response to the crisis is basically to internalize all the problems, and therefore you want to just shut yourself off from the rest of the world. So the Europeans have become against migration, against enlargement, against trying to minimize their contact with people outside. And the Russian response is, you know, we're partners in decline, we're both screwed, we need to get together, and, you know, Putin offers us a union between Russia and the European Union. And the Russians were saying to us, you know, you have to understand, you know, what we bring to it. We bring 140 million, because they count Ukraine, obviously, in terms of their ability to bring people with them to this union, and it would be a great help to the European Union. And, you know, I had to say to them, you know, if we wanted 100 million poor people outside the EU, we might have let Turkey in a few years ago. I mean, it is almost the exact opposite. But there is a window to have a different conversation with the Russians now from what we've had before. Russia is a very volatile place. We don't know how its political landscape is going to change over the next period of time. It's clear that once the transition is decided, there'll be less fluidity there. So it seems like a good time, actually, to have negotiations and discussions. And I think Poland has been a kind of leader in that area. We've seen, you know, from the outside, the impressive way in which Poland-Russian relations have Polish-Russian relations have been reset, and how that's helped increase Poland's credibility within the European Union, but also I think has brought some stability to relations with Russia. There's a bigger picture, obviously, with the US reset, which provides a wider context to it. But I think that's an opportunity which we shouldn't let go, because it's quite possible that if oil prices go up, that we'll see a less friendly Russia to deal with in a couple of years' time. And I think we should do all we can to try and put the relationship on a better footing in these circumstances. But equally, on the European side, I think that we're absolutely not assuming that Europe will speak with one voice. I mean, the point is, it's kind of up to you how we go forward. Because Europeans will talk to Russians in all sorts of different ways. There's lots of, you know, we've seen the Polish-Russian love-in. There's a de ville format for talking to the Russians. There are all sorts of other formats through which we can talk to the Russians, which will go on. And the EU isn't organically going to speak with one voice. We've seen over the years that sometimes divisions are so great that it's even impossible to have a discussion about Russia in formal institutions, because there's so little shared sense of analysis and of what's going on within Russia amongst the different member states. But as part of the research for this report, we did a survey of the security elites in the 27 member states. And I was frankly amazed at the responses on Russia, because ECFR started with a report which we launched in this very room, actually, in the Polish edition 3 years ago, called A Power Audit of EU-Russia Relations. And that showed these kind of deep divisions between member states. And actually, I don't think Europe has ever been as united on Russia as it is today. And we're creating a new institution, which is meant to be developing foreign policy. So if you task that institution with managing bits of that relationship, we'll then force the member states to come together and give a mandate to Ashton, whoever. Now, it might be a naive idea, but I think there is some, you know, grounding for it. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel, you know, met with Dmitry Medvedev in Merseburg last year and talked about setting up a security dialogue between Ashton and the Russians, which was precisely, you know, it was a bilateral version of what we were suggesting here. It's not a new institution. It's not a formal thing. It is more like a kind of round table. It might not be realistic, but if you don't do it, then it's clear how discussions with the Russians will go. So I think if you don't like the de ville format, then there is a good reason to try and promote other formats. And that sort of... maybe I'll leave it there.
Okay, Mr. Trzaskowski, please.
Well, one thing is that we all agree that the European Union is not speaking with one voice, and my colleague has just commented on what was happening in, when it comes to the European Union's reaction towards what was happening in Northern Africa, and he said quite aptly that the United States were actually one step behind the events. The European Union was one step behind the United States, and Cathy Ashton was one step behind the European Union. And I mean, and that is the problem, that not only we have that problem, we have had it for the past years, that we are unable to speak with one voice. With this institutional turmoil, I mean, this situation has been even worsened. And my question to you is whether this kind of format, wouldn't it actually increase the temptation of some member states to do things bilaterally? That is my question. Because we all agree that we should do something about Turkey, that we should do something about Russia, and that ideally we should speak with one voice. My fear is that creating that sort of format would actually increase the temptation to go bilaterally, and moreover, increase the temptation of Turkey and Russia banding together to actually start playing us one against the other. I mean, the Russians are masters at it. And sometimes even when you look, for example, at our own European Union project, which is the whole Black Sea synergy, sometimes you can see that Russians and Russia and Turkey actually banding together to actually play us one against the other. And I'm just afraid that creating such a format in such circumstances actually can worsen the current situation than improve it. I hope I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I don't think so, unfortunately.
Thank you. Mr. Iskowski, please.
Thank you. I think Mr. Trzaskowski touched on a very important issue of instability of trilateral arrangements, and most of such arrangements are unstable because usually they end up with a coalition of two against the third one. And also, very important remark which Mr. Krastev included in his response now about absence of the EU from important bodies and the need of strengthening the European presence, the EU presence in security structure and so on. And those are two elements. The third one is the unclear position of Turkey in a case of launching the scheme which you propose, because Turkey would be put in a double position, first of an applicant. So, in fact, from the EU point of view of the common policies, really a bigger Bulgaria, because the accession negotiations do not end up with EU changing its rules. They end up only with agreement on how fast the entering country will introduce them. Or, in some cases, the EU agreeing that they will be not introduced by the new country, but it's not a real negotiation. So Turkey is not going to pursue its own agenda and changing things in Europe. But at the same time, the position of a privileged partner. And this is exactly what you are offering. This position of a privileged partner is a result of a natural or spontaneous processes which make Turkey much stronger. Well, I don't think that this scheme could work with all those caveats of instability of trilateral arrangements, of EU not being really a security actor, and of Turkey not being in an unclear position, being treated one day quite often the same people as an applicant and the other day as a very important partner. So rather than pursuing this idea, perhaps we could investigate other ways of putting Turkey and Russia on equal footing, because those countries are getting more and more equal to each other, because Russia is getting weaker and Turkey is getting stronger. And one imaginable way of doing so would be through really considering the prospect of Russia's membership in NATO. Just a few hours ago, there was an interesting speech by a German general advocating the idea and pointing to the conditionality of NATO membership. That, in fact, the same way as EU changes the applicant countries during the negotiations procedures. What we have managed to do is with Turkey, the NATO also changes the applicant countries. And it includes not only the civil control over army, but also all other kinds of democratic process, legal system, and so on. And obviously, this, in case of Russia, would not happen quickly, but perhaps it's a better, you know, like, think a better way of thinking about quite distant future. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcin Wojciechowski, please.
I'd like to thank you for your report, which is quite inspiring and even provocating. And I'd like to say you are not only good expert, but also good writers and columnists. And my impression is you try to impress your reader, sometimes maybe too much, but I can forgive you, because I do the same in my text sometimes. I'm not so pessimistic and critical toward Europe like you, and I think it's not only my personal perspective, but perspective of new member states. We have and we are in much more effective, functional, and fair system than we were before. I do not only mean the communists, but the years before joining EU. EU strategy in foreign policy is maybe not so ambitious we would like to be, but it's much more effective than our national strategies where we were separated states. So I could use metaphor that we change our old Russian Lada or Volga into the old Mercedes-Benz, and of course we would like to have the last model of Mercedes-Benz, but the old Mercedes are quite functional. And I could give you a quite lot of examples that from our perspectives, it really works. And the most weak point of your report, in my opinion, is that you propose the strategy or. You propose Turkey and Russia as strategical partners of EU, and you don't mean any other factors or subjects. And it recognized to me a Polish debate on Russia and Ukraine. You know, some experts say Russia first. Other experts say Ukraine first. And my response is very clear. We need both. We need good relations with Russia and with Ukraine. And I think that we could use the same strategy in thinking of EU foreign policy. We need Russia, Turkey, and the rest. So Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Balkans, after the last events, Northern Africa. And my question is, if after the last events in North Africa, you'd like to put any changes into your report. So how can you see this region in the context of the last revolutions and especially in the context of Mediterranean Union, which was not so effective, but maybe has some new prospects in the context of last events. Thank you.
Thank you. Ambassador Zhukovsky. No, your neighbor for the moment.
Thank you, Marek Zhukovsky. Thank you very much for this report and for this idea to create the trilogue. But you are right, absolutely, that these two big European and transatlantic narrative we succeeded as Europe and also first of all Poland last 10-15 years now is almost over. Maybe no, we see that these both two big ideas, the contents of these big two ideas, is not so substantial it was 10 years ago, and really the evidence of Turkey shows that we as Europe and as a European Union has no so substantial offer for our neighbors. It was for us and it was before. But it creates, of course, many problems. You stress on this. But to replace or to find a way to discuss this all these problems to putting the next format of dialogue, I doubt it will be really not useful but really effective one, because if we there is not only the history of these big two narratives. The last 20 years also there is a history of ineffectiveness of many formats, many organizations, OIC, Council of Europe, many other formats. We have too much formats of dialogue. Ineffective one. And if you could raise, it is a question, on what these three sides sitting on one table could take a real decision, substantial decision on European problem in next 2 weeks, two years, for example. Well, if so, I could agree for this format. If not, it will be empty formula. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Novak, Bartłomiej Nowak.
Bartłomiej Nowak. Mark, apologize if I remind some of my points from yesterday. Mark, what has happened with your optimism? I mean, last 20 years...
You are really repeating yourself, yeah.
Yes, last 20 years, it is a great success of the EU integration. Some years ago, you wrote an excellent book on this, Why Will Europe Run the 21st Century? And my second issue, it's a sign of time, or rather, maybe disillusion, that you've got only a couple of voices, very modest, that the weakness of this report is that it does not recognize the countries in between the EU and Russia. And that's the trouble of mine with that report. I've got also the trouble with looking for the grand bargain of today, in looking for stability in a completely unstable world. I'm not in favor of a zero-sum game of Gideon Rahman, who wrote this excellent book as well. So I would stop at the moment of analyzing in this report, not creating something new. And my trouble with that kind of settlement with Medvedev's proposal is that please take into account that I think there is a hidden assumption in Medvedev's proposal that you cannot freely choose your alliance in security issues. Medvedev's proposal is not the first and not the last one on European order from Russians. So I'd be very careful when it comes to some points. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Czosek, please.
May I speak Polish? My account is that in English I can express about 20-30% of that I can do in Polish, in my native
language. I can try to translate.
And I have
my Polish is very colorful. I will translate to Mark Leonard.
I hope that the interpreters are much better.
There is translation? I didn't know.
Let's take your headphones okay. And... Yeah. I will speak Polish.
No, I don't
need. Rzeczywiście. Przeczytałem. Okay.
Just wait. Okay. Sekundę. Na który to jest numer? To jest jedynka? Yes?
It's okay. Okay.
Ponadto Duma mi nie pozwala mówić po angielsku, słuchajcie.
Proszę bardzo.
Po pierwsze, przeczytałem dokładnie raport, a potem dosłaliście państwo jeszcze takie wypowiedzi ekspertów. Oj, za głowę się złapałem po tych wypowiedziach ekspertów, ponieważ w drobiazgi to zostało zniszczone tymi wypowiedziami i chciałbym się nie zgodzić z ekspertami i życzliwie powitać tego rodzaju raport, co wcale nie znaczy, że jego propozycje są realne i mają jakąkolwiek szansę na powodzenie. Wątpię w to bardzo. Ale sposób patrzenia jest fascynujący. Chociaż gdybym już się miał dołączyć do grona krytyków, to co mówił pan Wojciechowski przed chwilą, ja jestem bardziej optymistyczny na osiągnięcia Europy, aniżeli panowie w raporcie to opisują. Może to wynika z mojej biografii. Ja w takim już dojrzałym wieku dołożyłem w jakimś tam sposób ręki do zmiany systemu. I jestem bardzo żywotnie zainteresowany tym, żeby koń, na który postawiłem jako dorosły człowiek, znów się nie ochwacił. O, nie przetłumaczyłbym tego słowa. I może patrzę z nadmiernym optymizmem na to, co się w Europie i u nas dzieje. Że ściągam rzeczy dobre. Patrzę zawsze od strony tej połowy pełnej szklanki, a nie pustej. Ale i to się zastrzegam. Ale jednak to jest udany eksperyment Europa. Mimo wszystkich tych strasznych rzeczy, które panowie piszecie w tym raporcie o różnych tam złych stronach.
Ale oni nie kwestionują. Ja
bardzo to chciałbym z innej perspektywy to, ale to jest tylko krytyczna taka drobna uwaga, gdyż wnioski będą te same. Po pierwsze, nie ma pomysłu na Europę poza tym, które do tej pory sprawdził się. Rozszerzenie o kraje Europy Środkowo-Wschodniej i zmęczenie materiału, rozczarowanie. Rozumiem tę koncepcję, że ten trójkąt Unia, Turcja. Nie wierzę w to, żeby Turcja szybko weszła do Unii Europejskiej. Z bardzo wielu przyczyn nie chcę rozwijać myśli. A więc to jest jakieś wyjście dla Turcji. Rosja, nie wierzę w to, żeby wstąpiła do Unii Europejskiej. To też jest jakieś wyjście dla Rosji. Tego rodzaju uczestnictwo. I tak to widzę jako bardzo takie rozumne, inteligentne rozwiązanie. Między innymi w wyniku tego, że się Europa strasznie zmordowała tym rozszerzeniem, przypomina tego węża boa, który połknął krowę i nie może tego strawić po prostu. No, a więc to jest to jakaś próba. Kolejna sprawa. Coś trzeba zrobić w końcu z inicjatywą Miedwiediewa. No, takie proste odtrącenie tej całej sprawy byłoby niedobrą rzeczą. Ja widzę bardzo wiele również złych, choć i dobrych intencji w tej propozycji, ale tu jest próba wyjścia naprzeciw Rosji, a nie odtrącenie wyciągniętej ręki. Z autorów, którzy tutaj się wypowiadali krytycznie, przekonuje mnie jednak ten pogląd, że za łatwo panowie godzicie się z tym, że nie będzie Stanów Zjednoczonych Ameryki u nas. w Europie, że ja nie bardzo wierzę, żeby tak zmalał problem Europy, żeby Amerykanie sobie dali z tym spokój. Wcześniej czy później Europa może się bardzo gwałtownie upomnieć, ta szeroka, kontynent mam na myśli, dać o sobie znać. Więc Amerykanie będą i uważam, że jeśli mamy mówić o jakiejś konstrukcji geometrycznej, to widziałbym czworokąt, a nie trójkąt. W jakimś udziale Stanów Zjednoczonych Ameryki, które nie powinny uciekać z naszego kontynentu, mamy wspólne interesy i wspólne zagrożenia. To ja mówię tylko hasłowo, mogę do wieczora na ten temat, a więc mówię hasłami, tylko
bardzo proszę.
Słabość tego materiału też, co ze strefą buforową. Mam Ukraina, Białoruś, Mołdawia, Gruzja, ale też inne te państwa. Tu nie ma pomysłu. Ale ja i tym kończę. Znaczy nie zgadzam się też z takim... Znaczy uważam, że polska myśl polityczna nie wydała z siebie żadnej koncepcji. I nie może być tak, że odrzucamy pomysły, które przychodzą do nas z zewnątrz w postaci tego raportu, tylko dlatego, że swoich własnych nie mamy, bo my się Rosji boimy. Na szczęście jest już dzisiaj inaczej. Choć w głębi duszy ja bym miał wątpliwości, czy przestaliśmy się bać, czy to nie jest czynnik główny różnych naszych poglądów na świat najbliższy. I to na przykład, im bardziej czytam dzisiaj w tych materiałach, im bardziej na wschód, w stronę Azji, tym mniej tej koncepcji w handlu, ale i w polityce win-win, że każdy zwycięża, obydwie strony zyskują, a tym bardziej koncepcja zero-jedynkowa, to już kończę. I dzicz następuje oraz kto kogo do ziemi zakopie. To nie jest tak. Rosjanie w moim przekonaniu mają dokonali strategicznego wyboru, czy też dokonują strategicznego wyboru. To nie jest rzecz, którą można zlekceważyć. I dlatego próba wyjścia naprzeciw powinna być życzliwie powitana, również przez polskie elity polityczne. Problemem, i to jest ostatnia dla mnie kwestia, ale nie do autorów, a do nas wszystkich, co z tego wziąć do naszej praktyki politycznej? Jak to zrobić, żeby to nie było taka kolejna pogaduszka salonu politycznego jakiegoś zebranego sobie gdzieś tutaj w zacnej fundacji Batorego, żeby choć troszeczkę trafiło coś z tego do praktyki politycznej. I tego nie wiem, jak to zrobić, to ja tylko mówię po to, żeby to zaznaczyć. Prezes fundacji jest słuchany, to chcę komplement pewien powiedzieć, czytany. Mam nawet artykuł ostatni, wypowiedzi i byłoby dobrze, i to jest mój taki apel do pana Smolara, żeby część z tego raportu, pewne myśli, żeby zechciał wziąć jako swoje i je nieco rozpropagować. Wtedy szansa na to, że dotrafi do praktyki politycznej, będzie o wiele większa. Dziękuję.
Dziękuję bardzo. Tylko uwaga właśnie, że myśmy przełożyli po to, żeby rozpropagować, mimo to, że osobiście
tak,
się nie zgadzam.
Prawda.
Dobrze. Teraz mamy dwie ostatnie. Nie, już Krzysztof, nie, już jest późno. Proszę bardzo, pan i później ambasador Tofpik zakończy. I ty, Andrzej, chciałeś jakiś Cishenrów, tak? Dobrze, ale proszę bardzo, niech pan zaskoczy. Jest problem z czasem trochę.
I am the only one in this room of the Polish experts who wrote commentaries concerning your report, so I feel obliged to some extent to contribute somehow to our debate. I wouldn't like to go into details of my commentary because you will be able to read all of them in English. They will be translated into English in the coming days. Nevertheless, I would like to focus only on one issue, which is for me a very interesting, is and one of my objections to your report is almost complete lack of focus on China. And in my opinion, right now you are facing the rise of China also in Europe with regard to the EU, Russia and Turkey respectively. Probably Turkey is the least known case among these three angles of this triangle. So I would like only to provide you with two very interesting developments. Last year, for example, the Turkish armed forces for the first time in their history conducted common military exercises with the Chinese friends, and also in autumn the Chinese Prime Minister visited Turkey and signed many very important agreements, especially concerning the development of the Turkish railway infrastructure, because the Chinese are of course clever guys and they would like to have an alternative road to Europe, not only through Kazakhstan and Russia. So my question is, what do you think about the prospects of China's leverage, rising leverage on Europe, on these three players? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Tofik, please.
Thank you very much for inviting, and sorry for being late for this meeting. And, well, my first question is that I don't understand why so many people dislike your paper or hated it, because I would say
this is coquetry of Ivan.
And this is because I understand from this discussion that I would say many people like this paper, and I do. I like this paper, but I would say for different reasons than you present it, because and because I don't believe that we have had so far unipolar Europe, and it is becoming multipolar. In this sense, I would say nothing has changed substantially. But I agree with you that European Union has many fundamental questions, but two of them is what kind of relationship should be established with Russia because also of Central Europe, of Central Asia, and what kind of relationship with Turkey also because of the future relationship with the Muslim world. And I listened to this discussion with great interest, and I must say I like many what you presented. But it seems to me that my main objection is that if we approach this way, whether Turkey and Russia should be treated on equal footing. They are completely different for different reasons, also because of the process of application and so on and so on. So second, I don't believe, and especially for the reasons presented by Andrei Ananich, that a solution for Turkey is really a realistic, I would say, because of a different position of Turkey and because of the position of member states of the European Union. So I would, I understand we don't have much time, but I would suggest to continue with your, I would say, research on this question, and to find, after so many discussions, some maybe new ideas, and to continue discussion, because these two questions which you raised are very fundamental because of the future of European Union. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't notice beforehand. I'm sorry. You have floor, please.
Adam Szymański, University of Warsaw. Just a short question concerning Turkey. I'm wondering, as it case of so-called strategic dialogue, this kind of idea also appeared. Also in this case, in case of this trilogue, what could actually the EU offer Turkey? Because you are writing, for example, about opening of new this blocked now chapters. I don't think it is realistic, because first for such countries as France or Cyprus should be convinced to change their position. So what could be the offer on the EU side to Turkey, which will be at the same time realistic and effective? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Angie, if you want, but short
to make a positive move. This is the part of this discussion. What can be picked from this report? I very strongly advocate for enhancing the political role of both partners. In the case of Turkey, Turks could be included into decision-making processes on political issues, as if they were in the state of a country that finished negotiations. The formal status is there. That would make dramatic positive change. Look at the situation right now. We are complaining about lack of analysis and decision on the Arab world. Why shouldn't we invite Turks to discuss what to do prior to taking decisions? Similarly with Russia, it has started. So this is the answer to Ambassador Joseph. What can be picked up? This can be picked up. But I doubt if the best way is to do it in a trilateral format.
Yeah. Just if I can ask the last to say a few words. With a pleasure, I heard many arguments almost a year ago, I believe, I used against the authors. I think that the analysis of the situation in three partners are brilliant. The problem is interconnection between them. The triangle, Iskoski is right, the triangle, this is strategically, this is invitation for a disaster. It almost automatically means coalition of twos against one. And this is very easy to imagine who will be in coalition. This is Turkey and Russia. Actually, as it was mentioned, their relations are quite close already, and not because they are treated badly by the European Union. Second argument, you didn't say it. It's quite interesting. You, in your paper, at least in the English version I read, you stressed that for you this is the road for Turkey to European Union. You didn't say it now. Or I think that the result would be just the opposite, because the Turkey will have one more mint to play, to use, to enlarge the sphere of freedom of action. And of course, the position of Turkey will be even reinforced. The same with Russia. It will be a disaster for European Union, because as Shaskovsky said, of course, European Union, this is not one actor. And this is oversimplification in spite of all your remarks. European Union is not an actor. It would be all in the Europe would pay for it. So let's say, It was mentioned by Krzysztof that the idea of Andrzej, I didn't know about this triangle, Russia, Turkey, Iran. I read in the Turkish journal, Zeman, or what is the name?
Zeman.
The idea of the common front of Turkey and Ukraine, because of the attitudes of European Union. This is another possibility. And the last argument I used as well, this is the problem of the lands in between. That Americans do not want to talk about Ukraine, this is not because they are considered that this is European problem. They are considered, this is the consequence of Georgian war and election of Ukraine, that it is Russian sphere of influence. And in your paper, implicitly, although probably this is against your will, this is the recognition of Russian sphere of influence. Because for Russia, there is no any deal possible with the European Union without recognition that this is Russian sphere of influence. So let's say, on the level of analysis, in the three blocks or three countries, this is absolutely brilliant. In the same time, the vision of interconnection between them, well, I'm... well, we know the conclusion. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm sorry, Ivan. Okay.
Because there was some interesting
stuff. Of course, you have time now to answer.
No, it's okay.
I have forgotten that this is your turn to answer.
First of all, after listening to Alec, you know how soft you are. We were treated so hard before it was published that now anything that we're going to hear is just fine. There are just three very simple things that I want to do, to make. First of all, on the sphere of influence, I want somebody to explain me exactly what it means today. Is Lukashenko in the Russian sphere of influence?
This is a good point.
Okay. Yeah. Why I'm saying this? Because basically we're using certain metaphors here and there. We don't remember anymore what exactly we're doing because it's very much about symbolic politics. We can talk much longer on Ukraine. But I do believe that exactly this type of thing is very important for me because most of the things that people are saying, and I agree, by the way, we made a mistake coming with the last policy recommendation part. So when you're saying what we're going to change, we're going to change this because in a certain way, what we wanted to do is much more to provoke a discussion on the problem of European order and to put this as a question, but people started to treat us on the way we're answering the question. And this was not our strongest part. But if this is the case, listen where European Union goes. Most of the people said we're never going to have one voice. At the same time, we're creating institutions that should produce one voice. As a result of it, we end up even more divided, and this was come from somebody from the European Parliament. So we don't know what Ashton is doing, but we're basically creating Ashton. As a result of it, you're creating one more obstacles for foreign policy process. This is a recipe for being ineffective, and I don't believe it's personally for Ashton. Honestly speaking, put whom you want. If he's going to be treated by the French, Germans, and Brits as a non-actor, he's going to be a non-actor. The second problem is with Turkey. For example, German position is the following. He said, with Russians, we are fine, because they know what are now the limits of their influence, so we can talk. Turks, we should wait for them to be exhausted. After they're going to be humiliated several more times, like with the Iranian stuff, they're going to understand that there is not much to do and they're going to talk to us in a different way because now they're pushy and overambitious and so on and so on. It's good if you believe that you have a total control over events. But here I very much agree with Andrei Ananić. At the moment, for me, the practical question is, do we go with the Turks together to the Middle East? Do we go on our own? Do we want to stop the Turks to go? And this is a strategic question. And from my point of view, and this was going my last point on Medvedev initiative. Okay, there is no Medvedev initiative. Because this was part of the Russian diplomacy. They declared that they don't like the current European architecture. And after that, they said, come with the ideas and we're going to tell you, do we accept them or not? So from this point of view, they're much more trying to position themselves as approving and disapproving than putting content. Because having principles, signing a treaty, okay. But at the same time, what we're doing, we start all the time saying, no, the status quo is perfect. Listen, status quo cannot be perfect if some of the major players does not accept its legitimacy. Because as a result of it, they claim legitimacy to play against it. I was strongly against this division between Kosovo and the way we're treating South Ossetia and Abkhazia. We should have pushed for South Ossetia and Abkhazia the same policy like in Kosovo. International presence, democratization, and after that you can go on referendum. The chances to have an influence was much higher than a situation in which we went with the recognition of Kosovo and after that we were shocked. It's a good reason that Russians did it in a way that didn't help them much. But my idea is we are simply trying to deny that anything out of the status quo is viable. As a result of it, this status quo is degrading. This is our major point. Yes, the situation is fine. And no one of us is undermining the achievement. Having Bulgarian commenting on the European Union is already kind of an achievement in its own. By the way, I realized listening to you that being Bulgarian, I'm the only one that have been part of the periphery of the all three empires. We have been in the Turkish one. We have been in the Soviet one. Now we are part of the European Union, so probably this is where it all comes from. But the idea was to create informal mechanism, which is going to be much more pushed on crisis by crisis discussion.
to upgrade this and to try to come with a common framing of security problem when it comes to Europe. Because the United States are going, in many cases, to come, but they're going to come only in the situation of a crisis and basically as a guarantor of last resort. They're not going to spend most of their time discussing what's happening in Europe. And if you have Middle East on the plate, if you have Pakistan and others, to blame the Americans for this, I do believe, is also very selfish. And on China, I'm going to leave to Mark. He's the Chinese guy.
You can see it immediately. Go on, Mark.
I think that's the thing. I'll start with what happened to our optimism. I mean, I think the main critique of this is that it's too optimistic about the European Union. I mean, I'm not going to repeat in every single thing I write that I think the European Union is the most important innovation in the organisation of power in 500 years, and that the EU is a kind of miracle in the way that it's reshaped the security rules, etc. And you know, you don't have to tell people in Poland that the world is a better place in 2011 than it was in 1988 or 81 or whatever. So, we're taking that for granted. That is an incredible achievement. It's wonderful. But the way that we need to organize ourselves for the next phase of the European project is going to be different from the last 20 years, because countries of Central and Eastern Europe have joined the European Union. As I said before, Russia is more powerful than it was a few years ago. Turkey wants to play a different role. The United States is returning to offshore balancing. Ukraine doesn't want to transform itself to become a modern European power. So how do we deal with this? Do we just say, okay, we'll enlarge the European Union and NATO, even though most member states don't want to, most of the countries that we're talking about don't want to join it, and we will refuse to have any discussions about any other way of dealing with security issues? Or are we going to try and explore whether there are ways of having more legitimate foundations to deal with the many security issues that we're dealing with at the moment, which some of the other powers will buy into? It's quite clear that if you create an informal structure where Russia and Turkey gang up against the European Union, it will meet once, and then we'll stop going to it, because it's not a formal structure. It's not an institution like the WEU Parliamentary Assembly that is still there, you know, many years after the WEU existed, because it's based on a treaty. We're not talking about creating any new structures. We like the old structures. It's just that the Russians and the Turks don't, and they're not working. If they like them, then they wouldn't be a problem. And I think that in terms of Ivan spoke very well about the kind of challenge for getting European unity and why, you know, if we're going to create these institutions, the very least we should do is try and make them work. And I think that if we don't want to have a high representative who's able to talk to Turkey and Russia about common security problems, we shouldn't have created a high representative. Having created them, it's crazy not to at least try and get them to speak for us. Those are a few more points. On China, I really have to say that I think that's there's a question about whether the US is a permanent European power and whether it's going to be interested in solving problems like Transnistria and Georgia, etc. In my mind, there's no question about whether China is going to be a permanent European power that's interested in solving those problems. I mean, China is developing economic and military and other kinds of relationships in Europe, and that's fine, but it's not a stakeholder when it comes to managing European security. And I don't really think that it's undermining the European Union's ability to do those sorts of things, except in a very marginal way, in that, you know, in Moldova, for example, if the Moldovan government can get a bailout from the Chinese, it might make it slightly less open to European conditionality if we're trying to give them money or the IMF is trying to give them money in the same way that African countries have sometimes been able to use China to play off against multilateral institutions. But, you know, if we were serious about really engaging and influencing Moldova, I mean, I don't think China's going to be the barrier. I think Turkey and Russia are much more likely to be barriers to our policies in the European neighbourhood than China anytime soon, because Europe is so low on the list of Chinese priorities. I mean, Chinese companies will follow markets wherever they exist, and the Chinese will be very good at trying to disrupt common European positions on issues which they care a lot about. So if it looked like we were going to have an effective policy on the Dalai Lama or on something like that, they'll go and screw up the European unity if they can. But Europe's not very high on the agenda of the Chinese state, so they're not going to be able to devote the resources that they would need to have much of an impact on European security.
Thank you very much. I think that we've got an extremely interesting document, even if we are not in agreement with the thesis formulated. Still, intellectually it's stimulating, and for political thinking certainly it can contribute in a positive or negative or semi-positive, semi-negative way. Thank you very much for both of you and to all of you, and certainly we will have an occasion to see more often. Because as you know, we are creating European ECFR, European Council of Foreign Policy, here in Warsaw as a part of the network of ECFR. Thank you very much, and bye-bye.